Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for January 9, 2003. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. We've got two segments up for tonight. First, I'll speak with the economists Ellen Frank and Max Sawicki about the Bush tax plan, fiscal stimulus, ending the so-called double taxation of dividends and other outrages and mystifications. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with journalist Tim Shorrock, who grew up in South Korea and has spent much of the last 20 years studying and writing about that part of the world, about the crisis in the Korean Peninsula, as everyone is saying these days. Got an email a couple of weeks ago from someone who asked for more Max Sawicki, and we complied. We've got Max Sawicki lined up, and if the correspondent had been familiar with Ellen Frank, he would have asked for more of her, too. And we've got her as well. And they're both on the line and ready to speak. Welcome to WBAI, Ellen Frank and Max Sawicki.
Hi, Doug.
Max.
Yeah, hi.
Hello, Max. Max is an economist at the Economic Policy Institute. Ellen teaches economics at Emmanuel College in Boston. And our president, bless his heart, has proposed a gigantic fiscal stimulus package, although they don't want to call it a stimulus because that's supposed to bring back bad memories of the bad old Keynesian days. So it's a growth insurance package, I think is what they're calling it now, whose centerpiece is the elimination of the tax on dividends, stock dividends. First of all, Max Sawicki, tell us what exactly is in this package.
Well, the key features are the first thing you mentioned, the exemption of dividends received by individuals from all tax. The other key increase involved here is speeding up the phase-in of the tax cuts that were passed in 2001. Those consist primarily of reductions in the marginal rates for upper-income persons. There is an increase... there will be an increase in the 10% bracket, which affects everyone who pays any tax at all. But the bulk of the resources here are going to reduce the marginal rates for high-income people, high relative to most people, and for this new elimination of any tax on dividends.
And just how skewed is this to people in the upper brackets?
Well, it's radically skewed, as one might expect. The there are different numbers out there. The Urban Institute has done some nice tables, and Citizens for Tax Justice has a new distribution table as well. The bulk of the benefits are for the top 10% of the population, and of course the top 1% gets an inordinate portion of the benefits.
And of course, if I was a member of the Ford family, which relies on dividends from millions of shares of Ford stock, I'd be a very happy fellow. Ellen Frank, you've denounced rather passionately this dividend tax elimination. Tell us what you have against it.
Well, it's obviously, first of all, it's a giveaway to very, very wealthy families. If you took just the dividend tax cut and forgot all the other parts of the Bush tax plan, about 60% of the benefits flow to the top 10%, and an inordinate amount of the benefits flow to people with incomes of $1 million and more. One of the things that the Bush administration has been saying in its speeches and press releases is that not only is it not true that everybody owns stock, only less than half of the population owns stock, just slightly less than half, but still. It's also the case that most people who own stock hold them in 401k accounts and IRA accounts and other tax-exempt retirement accounts, and so they will see no benefit at all from this. This is a tax cut that accrues only to people who own stock in personal portfolios and who receive dividends on those stocks. And this is clearly mostly upper-income groups. Another really shameless...
Just a second, but when people who have their stock in 401k and other kinds of tax-sheltered retirement accounts withdraw it, they're taxed on it.
Yeah, they're taxed on it at ordinary income rates, including, by the way, any dividends that have accumulated in their accounts over the years. So if this law passes and 10 years from now I retire and take my money out, the dividends that I earned on those accounts will be taxed at ordinary income rates, whereas if I had earned them outright, not in a retirement account, the dividends wouldn't be taxed at all. So it's an incredibly skewed toward not just the upper classes, but toward the very, very upper classes. The package was sweetened to some degree with some breaks for lower middle class taxpayers and even lower class taxpayers with the extension of the child credit and as from $600 to $1,000, and as Max mentioned, the increase in the minimum amount of maximum income one could have to qualify for the 10% tax bracket. But those are tiny in comparison to the size of this dividend tax cut.
And Max Wicker, do you have any dissent from that, or are you pretty much in agreement?
Well, the tax deferred accounts, the 401ks and your IRAs, you do pay tax on the withdrawals, but you get a deduction for the contributions. And the foregone tax on the contributions, roughly, and of course your mileage may vary in this, as a lot of other things, offsets the future tax on the withdrawal. So, in effect, the appreciation you get, the capital appreciation you get in these tax-deferred accounts is not taxed. Now, clearly, you don't get anything extra from the Bush proposal because you're holding those things away from tax in the first place. The Ellen is right that it's people that hold stock separately and as well as other people that will be able to benefit from fun and games with the tax code, if they can afford the accountants to do it, they will benefit far disproportionately from this relative to ordinary folks. We shouldn't discount, I think, if you've got a couple of kids, $800 and you're of a moderate income level, $800, which is your child credit increase for the two of them, is not inconsiderable. The marriage penalty easing in this is worth a few $100. The 10% bracket is worth a few $100. Of course, this package is usually expensive, so it's possible to dole out some limited benefits for average folks. But I'm afraid that if people criticize this purely on the basis of the rich got a ton and everybody else didn't get anything, they're going to have some problems in that debate because other people do get something. They could get a lot more, and they should, but it's not quite nothing.
So why not just forget about the dividend part and keep all the stuff for everyone else?
Well, I would get rid of the rate increases, the rate decreases as well. You could do a lot more for lower-income people by using the income tax to provide relief against the payroll tax. Most workers, the majority, pay more payroll tax than they do income tax. So you could use the income tax to provide relief for that without actually touching the payroll tax itself or the Social Security trust fund. That would have much better stimulus on the economy than this monstrosity, and could even be a lot cheaper and third, do better by most people in terms of their after-tax benefits.
And you could make a strong ethical argument for cutting, giving some sort of payroll tax relief on the basis, on the grounds that payroll taxes are the most egregious case of double taxation of income in the federal tax code. A household who pay with a $50,000 a year income will pay income taxes on $50,000 a year income, and yet they'll lose $3,600 in payroll taxes before will nevertheless be subject to federal income tax.
Yep.
Yeah, well, this double taxation thing is interesting because the only place anyone talks about it is with dividends. But, you know, I pay a New York State and City tax on income that the feds have already taxed. Very selective concern about double taxation.
It goes further than that. The ordinary person pays tax on wages through the payroll tax and through the income tax, and then they pay as they use that income. In fact, in the case of dividends and corporate income in general, a lot of that is not subject to tax at all. Not only is it not taxed doubly, it's not taxed at all. It's subject to zero tax because there's ways the corporations have used to offset taxable income used to pay dividends, and there's recipients of that income, nonprofits, and as we mentioned, these tax-deferred things, there's no tax on that either. So the extent to which the corporate income is actually subject to tax is only about half of dividends are actually subject to tax under present circumstance.
Ellen, I remember once you said to me some years ago that rich people these days don't want to pay taxes. They want to be paid tribute. Are we moving?
Did I really?
Yes, you did. Are we moving further in that direction?
Oh, it certainly seems that way. I just find the the whole idea of eliminating tax on dividends, especially on the individual receipt of dividends, rather than on the corporate payment of dividends, which has some a little bit of economic merit. You could make an argument that it would improve corporate financing. But the elimination of the tax on individuals is really a giveaway to stockholders and to particularly the very wealthy. And one really wonders what it is these people want. I mean, it's not like they don't have enough money already. We've seen over the past...
You can never have enough money.
But we've seen over the past year these story after story of these phenomenal, really astounding amounts of money that people have taken out of corporations. You know, people like Gary Winnick with $734 million from Global Crossing. The story of Jack Smith at General Electric and his Jack Welch and his exorbitant retirement package, and no matter how lavish these people's pay packages are, they just seem to want more and seem to resent even the minimal tax payments that they have to make.
Now, the president and his flacks say that eliminating the tax on dividends will be a great economic stimulus. What's the logic behind that, Ellen? And what's your reaction to it?
Well, the logic behind it, this is pure trickle-down supply-side economics. I mean, the logic of it is that markets are self-regulating, that they work fine without the government involvement, that the more the government is able to stay out of the market, give back money to the rich so that they can save and invest, the more growth there'll be and the better the economy will be. People in the Bush administration and the people who are advising the Bush administration do not really believe that economies suffer from long-term failures. They don't really believe that people are unemployed because they don't want to be or because they simply can't find jobs or jobs aren't available. They believe that the market will right itself and that the government's job is to give the wealthy the wherewithal to make the investments that promote growth, and that's their fundamental view. What I think is wrong with that view is that I think history shows that it's not true. There are periods when it's true, and there are periods when markets fail spectacularly, and in general, markets generate pretty much constant unemployment, and without some kinds of institutions to indemnify people against unemployment and against misfortune, most people will not do very well in a free market economy.
And now the president has signed some legislation extending unemployment benefits. What's the story with that, Max?
Well, I'm not very conversant with the details. They did basically the least amount they could get away with as far as that goes, and that's welcome. The chances are we could have used more, and incidentally, that sort of spending, if we had more of it, would be much more effective in terms of stimulating employment in the here and now than three times as much the way it's used in the Bush proposal. So, but, of course, they did what they needed to do. They did it a little bit late. People lost out before Christmas. They're supposed to get pay for that. So some people may get their Christmas presents a little bit later than they expected them, but... at least they've kept things on a moderately even keel as far as that goes.
Now, there's also this, $3,000 re-employment account.
Right.
What's the story with that?
Well, this is a new, strange and interesting thing. The idea is that if a worker makes his way through all of his unemployment benefits and still doesn't have a job, that he or she receives $3,000 to help them find a job through some sort of self-improvement, is the implication, or simply to spend as they please. Now, there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of what the rules for this would be, how it would be distributed among the states, the extent to which the states could use the money just to pay their unemployment benefits, which is one possibility that's been raised. The amount of money is also limited, so if there's more unemployed people than is allowed for in the bill, it's not an entitlement. You simply run out of money and you can't fulfill the remaining needs. So in that sense, it's a little bit like a lottery.
I saw several fatheads on Fox News the other night, like Mort Kondracki and Fred Barnes, sitting around talking about how the way it was structured would encourage people not to sit around and collect unemployment but go out and get a job. Because they're
well, actually, it could be the opposite, because you have to wait. You have to sort of go through all your benefits before you... get this payment, according to that. Now, I don't think people
like a bonus for
people with any sense sit around for the sake of collecting unemployment when there is work available. But if you were near the end of your benefits, and if you were a couple of weeks away, you could easily calculate the difference between collecting what's left or taking the $3,000. Although the $3,000 might not be a sure thing, and you might not be able to count on being one of the lucky people who receives it. So it's all a fairly murky area. It's a very small piece of the package. Don't forget this total amount of resources we're talking about here, $670 billion for tax cuts, $3.6 for this tiny benefit for a limited number of unemployed people. There's really a completely uneven disproportion of attention here to what I would say the main problem is right now, namely excessive unemployment and where the Bush administration is putting most of their most of our dollars, I should say.
That was the voice of Max Sawicki, who is a columnist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, and also on the line, Ellen Frank, who teaches economics at Emmanuel College in Boston. Well, Ellen, what's your judgment on how badly the economy needs stimulus? I think a lot of people in the administration are avoiding using words like that. They're talking about righting the long-term situation, but they're really skeptical about the value of short-term stimulus programs. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, actually, it's my impression that what they're doing right now is pretty much counting on the fact that expectations the economy doesn't need stimulus, but will come out of this at least enough over the next year. And it will get actually quite a bit of stimulus from this tax package next year if it goes through, because in addition to the dividend tax cut, there's a lot of other tax cuts in this package that would mean money in people's hands in 2003. And so I think they're counting on
2003 or 2004?
Well, some of it, I think the child tax credit and some of the reduction in brackets was supposed to kick in into people's paychecks by 2003, if enacted. That was my understanding.
The administration, there's an article in the New York Times, I believe, the administration itself has estimated the impact in this calendar year from their package, in contrast to this 2.1 million figure they've been throwing around, is 190,000 jobs created, according to them. Now, the 2.1 million, they say, would be created overall, God knows when and for who. They have not chosen to document in terms of how they arrived at that number. But the way this thing would be timed, the likelihood is that there would be more short-term effect in 2004 than in 2003, which could very well be too late for a lot of people.
Ellen, do you concur?
Well, I think that what they're doing is they're hoping that the economy will start moving again, which economies often do. I mean, we go through business cycles. You know, the economy goes into recession, it slows down, it's stagnant for a few years, and then there's a pickup as profits recover. You know, sometimes it happens after a year or two. Sometimes it takes 3 or 4 years. My guess is that the administration is hoping that it picks itself up by 2004 in time for the elections, and if it doesn't, then they can do more direct kind of stimulus packages then. And by direct stimulus, I mean actually spending money, like giving money to the state so that they're not laying off home health care workers and teachers and that sort of thing. That can always be done at the last minute if it needs to be done. And part of the reason I think the administration is avoiding talking about stimulus is not just because they don't want to make things sound bad for the public consumption, but because there is, on the administration's right, a very, very ferocious right-wing lobby that from the groups like the Cato Institute, libertarian, conservative economists, free enterprise nuts, who dislike the whole idea of government stimulus packages and who object to the use of that terminology at all.
You mentioned states laying off home health care workers and such. I think at last count, 38 of the 50 states were suffering severe budget problems. This state and our governor, this state is suffering, I think, $11 billion shortfall, and the governor wants to meet it all by service cuts and not tax increases. Is there anything in the administration's package that would ease the burden on states and localities? Max?
Just the opposite. They say that they're counting this unemployment program as help for the states, but insofar as the states could use it just to pay ordinary unemployment benefits, it would be a very small amount of help. But with the other hand, by contracting the federal tax base, they are automatically and instantly reducing income tax receipts state income tax receipts. The reason is that state income taxes are piggybacked onto the federal tax, so they automatically would lose. Now, the other thing, which is less more murky in terms of the extent of the effect, chances are that the tax-free state and local bonds used to finance infrastructure investment, which incidentally create relatively good jobs, these would be less favored under the new regime because you would now have these tax-free dividends. The tax-free nature of those bonds made them attractive, and they amounted to an indirect subsidy to state and local governments of in the neighborhood of $25 billion a year. So that's a negative factor. The other point is that there's an overall potential effect of higher interest rates from this package. One reason is that people are supposed to be buying this great stock because it is now paying tax-free dividends. Well, that means they're going to be selling something else. They're going to sell some other asset, a bond, a tax-free muni bond, maybe some security that's related to mortgages. So the value of some other assets, it seems to me, has to decline for the sake of people rushing into this new field of stock. So that means losses of wealth to some people. It could mean the loss of value in something as ordinary as a home. It could make mortgages more expensive. And the overall trend in terms of the budget outlook and long-term deficits projected, which are going to be much bigger than just this package reflects, could put upward pressure on long-term interest rates, all of which make it more difficult for state and local governments to borrow to finance their capital spending.
Now, we've gone from what the projections were, something like a $6 trillion surplus in the government accounts over the next 10 years, to something like now a $3 trillion deficit. And the Democrats are, insofar as they're reacting at all to the president's proposal, are complaining about its imprudence, its fiscal imprudence. Is this something that we should worry about terribly, Ellen Frank?
Well, I don't think that we need to worry about it. It's such a complicated question in some ways. I think politically, the deficit is a real problem. Whenever there's a deficit, whenever the government runs a deficit, certain groups will use that as an argument to cut government spending. And this has been a kind of platform of the Republican Party since the 1980s. First you cut taxes, then you have a looming deficit, then you say, well, the problem is not that we cut taxes, the problem is that the government spends too much, so we have to cut spending down to the level of the lowered tax receipts. And in that way, any public discussion of the need for new programs, of government response to economic distress, is just taken off the table, as it's been taken off the table in this country for the last 20 years as a result of this kind of deficit mania. And I think that there's no evidence that deficits have any particular harmful effect on the economy. I mean, there are arguments for taxing rather than borrowing from the rich. I think, there are probably good arguments, but it's not essential to do that. You can borrow from the rich or tax from the rich, but as long as you transfer resources.
But then you have to pay the rich interest for borrowing.
Yeah, but you
money.
Can tax their interest at very high marginal rates, which is what a lot of countries have done, which is what this country did in the post-war period. But the real issue is the politics of it. The public doesn't really understand deficits. Macroeconomics is complicated. There's a lot of controversy about their impact on the economy, and whenever we have big deficits, it always is fuel for the right.
Max, you're in Washington. What are the politics of this? Is this going to get through Congress intact, or what's going to look like after it goes through the sausage machine?
Nobody thinks it's going to get through intact. The question is how much resistance will be put up to the sort of major outlines of this. I saw Lincoln Chafee, who's a Republican, said he would not support it as is. The centrists who voted for the Bush tax cut in 2001, led by Senator Breaux from Louisiana, are saying they don't like it. So the indications are that it could have a very rough time. One thing that could help to discredit this whole thing is when stories start to leak out about the funny games that very wealthy people can play by virtue of this new complexity in the tax code, the kinds of arbitrage that can be pursued to not only reduce, to take advantage of the tax-exempt status of dividends to render other types of income tax exempt as well.
So we've only got a couple of minutes left. What would your ideal economic stimulus package look like, Ellen Frank?
Well, my ideal economic stimulus package doesn't have a snowball's chance in hell of being passed in the United States.
Well, we'll fantasize for
my
a moment,
generation, probably. But you know, I would love to see a sharply progressive tax system that was used to fund universal health care and other such social democratic benefits. That was the best case scenario. But the worst case scenario, I think, that I'd like to see today, that I think actually is enactable with a slightly different Congress, is at least to sustain state and local government spending through this recession, because that's where most of the real spending that people really count on for things like health and education and child care and social services and transportation, that's where it's being done. And if that spending is allowed to languish, and with all the Republican governors in office right now, I don't think there'll be any real pressure on Washington to prevent it from languishing. We're going to see a real retrenchment of government over the next couple of years.
Any comments on that, Max?
Well, the Democratic proposal, in terms purely of being focused on stimulus and the unemployment issue right now, is pretty good. There's, I think, the state aid component of it could be three times as big, and the tax breaks for small business, I don't think, are as effective as other things like the state aid. But the Democratic alternative is pretty good. The problem is that they're putting forward something that fits the usual textbook description of what a stimulus should be, and it also is roughly the right size, and about $170 billion, I guess. And they're competing with somebody who's playing a different game, who doesn't care about the deficit. The Democrats' political problem with the deficit, to an important extent, is self-created. And to my way of thinking, if they're going up against somebody that says, let's jump up the deficit by $670 billion, they should say, fine, here's how we would do it. That's how you would do it. And if there's going to be a budget debate, wait till the other side is debating budget and not hamper yourself by forcing yourself to be more virtuous than the other guy in terms of competing about how to move resources in the federal budget.
And what's going on with Social Security privatization, to change the subject a bit? Is that still in the president's mind? Did the results of the election embolden him?
I don't know where he would get the money at this point. You've got $670 billion in this package. There's another $220 or so billion in interest that this would cost. So already we're up to about $900 billion. You've got the missile defense system, several hundred billion. You've got the promise of prescription drug benefit, several hundred billion. You've got the need to fix the alternative minimum tax, which is something that would hit a lot of more people. And in order to avert that, you need to forego another $300 or $400 billion. You've got huge costs coming down the line, and it's hard to see where there's any room for the money you would need to transition from the current system to a privatized system, wholly apart from the fact that the privatized system would not be a good deal for most people anyway.
Yeah, Ellen, any comments on that?
Well, I don't think the fact that they can't afford it is going to stop them. Either they'll come up with the revenue somehow or simply cut benefits to make the numbers work. But I don't think that's on the agenda over the next year. I would guess that if the Republicans can hold on to the presidency in 2004, that it's in that next term that we'll start seeing action on Social Security.
All right. Well, thank you both. I've been speaking with Ellen Frank, who teaches economics at Emmanuel College in Boston, also a member of the editorial collective of Dollars and Cents magazine, and Max Sawicki, who is an economist, staff economist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington and proprietor of the blog maxspeak.org. Maxspeak.org.
I got a good buzz phrase for you from the world of blogs.
What's that?
Named Michael McInnes, who runs a blog called Renaissance Grouch, and he's coined the phrase taxes of evil.
Okay. All right. On that note, we'll end. Thanks to both of you, and we'll be back in a moment if the gods are smiling on us with Tim Sharrock.
Believe me.
Why not believe in me? We got to believe something. Why not believe in me? We got to believe something. Why not believe in me? We got to believe something. Why not believe in me? You got to believe something. Why not believe in me? You got to believe something. Why not believe in me?
And that was a little excerpt from Satoshi Tomy's compilation, New Breed 006. And you got to believe in something. Why not believe in me? So I can endorse that sentiment. My name is Doug Henwood, the program Behind the News on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the web at WBAI.org. And again, information on the previous guests. Ellen Frank is a member of the editorial collective of Dollars and Cents magazine. They're at dollarsandcents.org and the web, all one word. dollarsandcense.org. And Max Sawicki is the proprietor of a blog called Max Speak, MaxSpeak.org. And you can entertain yourself with Max's commentary on politics, updated frequently throughout the day. And now we're joined by Tim Schrock, who is a journalist based in suburban Washington, who spent his formative years in South Korea and has been observing and writing about the place now for almost 20 years, and author of a little think piece on the state of U.S.-Korean relations and such, which was recently posted to the website Foreign Policy and Focus, FPIF.org. Welcome to WBAI, Tim.
Hi, Doug.
So we've got several things going on what the pundits are now all calling the Korean Peninsula. We've got a new president coming in South Korea and, of course, the nuclear crisis in the north. First of all, what's happened with the new president of South Korea? Who is he and why was he elected?
He is a former human rights and labor lawyer. He was very active during the 1980s defending trade unionists and dissidents that were being jailed and repressed for their views, and was very active in the movement for democracy, and has been part of the Kim Dae-jung's ruling party, and has also been very supportive of the so-called sunshine policy toward North Korea. And he got a lot of votes from particularly young people on his stand that South Korea's got to be more independent of the United States, and the United States should no longer treat South Korea like a vassal, which it seems to like to do these days in particular, and has spoken out. He focused during his campaign in relationship to North Korea. He was saying how alarmed he was in 1993 when the U.S. nearly went to war over nuclear weapons at that time, barely consulting South Korea, which would have, of course, felt the brunt of any kind of war that would have happened. So he said that should not happen again, and said he would like to try to mediate or negotiate between U.S. and North Korea, and I think Kim Dae-jung has been supportive of that, too. And I think what happened in the last couple of days, when the Bush administration finally agreed to talk directly to North Korea, was largely a result of pressure from South Korea.
Now, the American right is, of course, rather upset about it. You quote in this piece Doug Bandow from the Cato Institute saying that it's time to have an amicable divorce between the U.S. and South Korea. What are they thinking?
Well, he's the more temperate of the lot, I would say, and he's actually been saying stuff like this, you know, for some time. But you have people like Robert Novak just, you know, blasting South Korea, you know, for its upstart stand against the United States, and comments in the New York Times about how the U.S. relations with South Korea, like riding a bicycle, teaching a child to ride a bicycle. In other words, they're basically children to us adults. And this kind of arrogance towards South Korea is really coming out. And I think people like, you know, Novak and other right-wingers were very, very happy with South Korea when it was under a pro-U.S. military dictatorship. In fact, Novak himself was wrote a lot of puff pieces about the dictatorship back in the 80s, I remember, and you know, so they're very, now the Koreas have full democracy and can actually, you know, people can speak out and speak their mind about the United States. A lot of right-wingers here feel, well, you know, well, heck, we're an empire. We shouldn't let our little countries we dominate go around telling us what to do. So you know, let's get out of there. But I do think it creates an opening because, after all, you know, why should U.S. troops be in Korea if South Korea doesn't feel like North Korea is a military threat? And those troops are there to stop a North Korean invasion, and then more lately just to be there just in case there is a war to ensure the U.S. is involved. And I think it's about time to start talking about, you know, how can troop withdrawal be part of a broader peace agreement in Korea? And I actually think that's what the issue now is. We should be focusing on is you know, I think this is an opportunity to actually, you know, bring this war to a final end. Let's just not have these crisis after crisis with North Korea. Let's, you know, meet, you know, talk to them about, okay, we're not going to attack you, and, you know, we're going to allow you to develop economically as you choose and allow North and South Korea to move ahead on unification and you know, back out of the way. And I think that there's an opening for that here.
Well, several years ago, South Korea had a real killer economic crisis along with many of its neighbors. The United States had some very definite opinions, which it pressed on the Koreans through the IMF, about how they should reform their economies. How much did that have an effect on U.S.-Korean relations, and how much has the economy recovered from that crisis?
It had a lot of effect because as Walden Bellow and some others have written, the U.S. got through the IMF negotiations what it failed to do in like 20 years of trade negotiations, particularly opening up financial markets and getting the ability for U.S. financial firms and investment banks and private equity funds, say like the Carlyle Group, to buy into take over Korean companies and that kind of thing. And that was a big change, as well as was the IMF, so some of the insisting on loosening the labor laws and changing labor relations. And of course, you know, Kim Dae-jung was very open to this and pushed through many of these changes. And I would say that relations between the trade union movement and South Korea are worse than almost under any president. I mean, there's still quite a few trade unionists in prison who had led strikes, resisting some of the layoffs and other things that happened during that time. So there was a lot of resentment about the U.S., but I wouldn't, I would say that it had a very, it was part of a lot of other grievances people hold toward the U.S. But in a lot of ways, the economy's recovered, and I think, various, they've been able to diversify to a certain extent, and also a lot of the big, the J-ball, the big conglomerates are no longer anywhere near as powerful as they used to be. And so in the companies that split off from them are able to sort of move ahead and, develop products without, the J-ball demanding, what they do and go into. There's more innovation, I would say, in the South Korean economy because of the J-ball have been greatly weakened.
Now, people like Doug Bandow and Robert Novak can, scream and all they like, but South Korea is a pretty important economic power. It's also pretty important strategically. Is it very likely that the United States is just going to pull troops out and let the Koreans go their own way?
Not immediately, no, I don't think so. But I do think that there is, the possibility is there. I mean, for years now, they've since the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the weakening of North Korea, the deterioration of North Korea's economy and its military strength, the rationale for those troops there has really diminished. But throughout this period, the Clinton administration, came up with a new rationale for having, all of the American forces in East Asia, including, Japan, which are all concentrated in Okinawa. And I think there is some thinking now going on, but it would not be any kind of like unilateral thing. That's what Nixon did in the 1971. He actually pulled out a whole division of troops suddenly, sort of as part of the phase out of Vietnam. But I think it's a possibility as part of a broader, peace process. Like for example, North Korea. One of the issues that soured talks between the U.S. and North Korea earlier, last year, like last June, was the U.S. Said, "Okay, we'll talk, anytime, any place." But they demanded certain things up front, such as a unilateral pullback of North Korean forces from the demilitarized zone, better known as the DMZ. And, you know, for North Korea, those troops are there to prevent a, you know, to stop an invasion of their country. And they weren't going to make any unilateral pullbacks. And but, you know, maybe later on, it's sort of confidence building, if a peace can be established, then, you know, both sides could perhaps, you know, be moving troops out. Our troops there are almost all concentrated on the border and are there as a tripwire. If there's a war, they're involved. So I think, you know, down the road, it's very possible.
I'm speaking with Tim Shorrock, who's a journalist who's studied South Korea for many years, written about it, and also author of a piece on the Korean crisis at fpif.org, the Foreign Policy and Focus website, and also a piece forthcoming in The Nation or The Nation's website?
That's correct. Both.
Both. Okay. In The Nation, that should be out at the end of the week. Let's talk a bit about North Korea then.
All right.
You in the Foreign Policy and Focus piece, you take American leftists to task for making fun of the North Korean regime. What did you have in mind when you're doing that?
You know, I mean, I myself as a journalist have been red-baited and Stalin-baited for years just for saying anything, you know, positive about North Korea.
That's not going to happen here, so go ahead.
It's not going to happen here, but I'm just, you know, there's a tendency on people on the left to sort of use North Korea as a whipping post to say, you know, look, I'm not a bad leftist like these terrible North Koreans. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk these days about, you know, who's leading the anti-war movement, right? Workers' World. Well, look at Workers' World. They support Kim Jong-il and so on and so forth. And we've seen that from, you know, a couple people that write for The Nation and sort of, you know, even going on Fox News and saying, complaining about leftists that support North Korea that are anti-war. And, you know, I just think that...
Now, that was David Korn.
That was David Korn.
Was not allowed to write those words in The Nation, just a clarification.
I guess not, but he did write a long article in L.A. Weekly.
Right.
But, you know, going on a Fox show with Bill O'Reilly and making, you know, sort of, you know, bashing other communists, I have some questions about that. But I think the greater issue is, you know, demonizing North Korea so you don't even try to understand any what goes into its thinking is just a wrong way to go. And it's, you know, you don't deal with the real reality of the situation. I mean, you know, Kim Jong-il is one thing. There's a military. There's an economic structure as deteriorated as it is. It's worth noting that, as you know, as recently as the late 1970s, North Korea's economy was more advanced than South Korea's economy in every gauge, according to a well-known CIA study at that time. And in fact, they had, you know, it is a Stalinist state. That Stalinism applies also to its political economy. I mean, they had sort of like, you know, socialism in one country, in a tiny, tiny country, which is very rare indeed. I mean, they had built their own, you know, electric utility system, railroads, and, you know, engines. They had quite an advanced, you know, building engines for machinery and so on. You know, quite advanced until, you know, the late 1970s, early 1980s. And then I think, you know, just the over-centralization, after a while, just couldn't move ahead in technology. And also the Soviet Union eventually collapsed and they lost all kinds of aid and benefits from trading with the Soviet Union. And so, you know, it's going downhill. But I think, you know, we on the left should not necessarily, you know, welcome them as friends, but try to understand their perspective and their point of view and not attack people that say, and, you know, that try to explain how North Koreans might see the world.
All right, well, give us an idea of how do they see the world? I mean,
I think they, you know, if you're talking about this particular situation right now, I think they see the United States as a threat to their sovereignty and their future and their security as a nation. And they've seen time and time again, they've heard time and time again, you know, statements from Bush about how much he loathes, you know, Kim Jong-il and how much he doesn't understand why we don't go ahead and topple him. Things like that. And, you know, the language, the axis of evil. Before that, saying North Korea could, you know, shoot missiles at Alaska as a reason for building, you know, the missile defense system, and the fact that, you know, we've had nuclear arms aimed at them for many years, they see the U.S. as a threat to their future and would like to have a situation where that threat does not exist. And that's one way they see it. And there's been, they're also trying very hard to move away from this Stalinist centrally planned economy and to something, you know, resembling what's going on in China. They're not going to copy all that, but there's elements of it already beginning. There's, you know, free trade zones and this, where they allow some, you know, foreign multinationals in. It's just, you know, sort of the same kind of model that China's following. And they're sending people, delegations all over different countries of the world. There was a large delegation of Korean, you know, people that run small enterprises and even some larger ones that were in South Korea for almost a month, about a month ago. They traveled all over, you know, went to factories and so on. They didn't understand how credit cards work, but, you know, they're learning about things like this. And they've sent, you know, some countries in the European Union have been, you know, training them. And they apparently, Kim Jong-il told Madeleine Albright that he likes the Swedish model. So apparently they've been actually met some Swedish diplomats about a year ago when I was in South Korea, and they said they'd been doing a lot of training of North Korean technicians there in sort of, you know, economic various parts of the economy.
Now, the administration, though, I watched Bush on TV just the other day saying we're not going to attack North Korea, and
right.
Somebody else was unnamed administration official was quoting the Times 4 or 5 days ago saying it may seem strange that we're looking to go to war with Iraq, which has let inspectors into the country, and we're not going to go to war with North Korea, which is kicked the inspectors out of the country, and we're still working on the rationale for this. But what do you think? I mean, is the administration's hands really tied because North Korea does have nuclear weapons that could blow away Seoul in an instant?
Well, actually, you know, I think that it's tied. I think it's more the destruction of a potential destruction of a war that, and the impact of that on the economies of South Korea, Japan, and, you know, China, the regional impact. I think that, you know, and also just, you know, tens of thousands of people would die. We're not talking about, you know, nuclear war, but
that never stopped the United States from starting wars. So
well, you know, that's true. It hasn't, you know, in certain times in the past, but I mean, in this particular situation, I think that is a big part of it. And I think if they can see a way to negotiate, you know, what they want, i.e., you know, a non-nuclear Korea, they will proceed in that direction. Whereas in Iraq, you know, I think clearly I'm not an expert on Iraq by any means, but I think the oil interest and the possibility of gaining control of that oil, you know, is probably a key element in thinking, you know, well, we can limit the war to Iraq. And, you know, I mean, I think it's stupid thinking, but I'm just saying that may be, you know, the contrast that may answer for it. In terms of what, you know, Bush has been saying, yes, he has said, you know, okay, we're not going to attack you. And he said that when he was there last year in South Korea. But they want, you know, an ironclad written kind of guarantee, like a treaty to spell it out. And today in the Washington Post, Secretary of State Powell actually said, I kind of understand that. Okay, you know, we might be willing to work with them on that. So I think, you know, there's been some movement there.
But, I mean, you know, these ghoulish hawks that occupy so much of the administration, they're talking about a non-aggression treaty with North Korea? It's just the House liberal Powell, or do you think this extends beyond the State Department?
It's hard to say, you know, from this close up, you know, how the decisions have been made. But I think that you know, it's important to remember that Powell was part of the Clinton team when they did negotiate this agreed framework, and when he was in the military, and so he has some understanding of how that came to be, and he today, you know, praised the agreed framework, which a lot of people in the Bush administration, the framework that Clinton negotiated with North Korea, and he had, you know, some very positive things to say about it. So it looks to me like a week or two ago, when he was, you know, splashed out on all five of the talk shows on Sunday, and this came like about 4 or 5 days after Donald Rumsfeld had said, you know, yeah, we're perfectly fit to fight two wars at the same time, and we could handle North Korea and Iraq at the same time. And I think, you know, somebody in the Bush administration decided that wasn't the message they wanted to send, and they sent Powell out. And he's clearly, you know, has angered some people on the right for doing this. But it looks from here that, you know, his sort of diplomacy line has won out over the more hawkish people, and it's not just Rumsfeld. I mean, his, you know, Wolfowitz was a key player in Reagan's foreign policy in Asia during the 80s.
Yeah, so the Daily Show said the other night, Iraq has oil, and North Korea on a good day has cabbage, and they're not about to go to war over cabbage. But do you think the North Koreans would be willing to give up their nuclear weapons, or is it just too important to them to keep that threat in hand?
I think they would give them up if they felt, if they believed that there was no threat of an attack or aggression from the United States, and that their sovereignty is going to be respected. I saw a statement they made not too long ago in one of their diatribes where they said something like, we regard sovereignty as more important than life itself. And they're really big on borders. I mean, when Vietnam invaded and occupied Cambodia, they were furious about, you know, violating a border, and they were even critical of the Soviet Union when it invaded Afghanistan. They're real big on, you know, independence and countries not invading other countries.
Yeah, and their economic strategy has long relied on self-reliance. What is it called? Juche, yeah. Just almost perfect self-reliance without much trade or aid from the outside world, right?
Well, yeah, that's right. And what I was saying before about this sort of Stalinist economy, they did go ahead and, you know, build their own machine industry, for example, and like the Soviets were like, you know, what are you doing this for? You should buy from us. I mean, the Soviets wanted to have this kind of relationship the U.S. had, where you know, they were buying the capital and, you know, technology intensive stuff. They wanted to sell to North Korea, instead of the North Koreans making it, but North Korea did. But that's no longer viable. I mean, they can't even feed their own people, and all these factories that were in existence, you know, 20 years ago are now, they're selling off the parts to China just for fuel and food. So something has got to change, and they don't, how many socialist allies do they have left? They got China maybe and Vietnam, but I mean, Vietnam's pretty much importing, you know, developing as a capitalist market economy itself. So they're pretty isolated, and so I think they see the way out as having South Korean companies invest there and learning some technology from them, and then concentrating on certain products that they might be able to make for a broader market.
And also, much to the chagrin of our hawks, a lot of South Korean companies are quite interested in investing in North Korea, aren't they?
Quite interested in going ahead with those investments as well. And so, you know, that's been happening. One of the interesting things that's in terms of U.S. and South Korea is that over the last, you know, as this has reached, you know, kind of crisis proportion here, all these kind of discussions between North and South on the rail, you know, they're building a railroad now from North to South Korea and laying the beds and clearing the land across the DMZ, and there's some projects going on, some free trade zones that are being built, and those projects have been going ahead as this has been going on. They've been meeting, they've been, you know, delegations have been going back and forth and that kind of thing. So they're just sort of like moving ahead on this sort of gradual process of unification. It's not going to be, you know, the two countries are going to come together as one for a long time, but, you know, there's going to be a process of cross-border exchange and more and more cooperation, I think, and that's what they'd like to see. And I think both sides, you know, the threat of war has to be lifted for that to happen, and also for the North Korea's economy to go ahead. And they need the sanctions by the U.S. lifted, because unless those are lifted, they can't get loans from multilateral banks, which they want for some of these projects to proceed. And you know, the dreaded World Bank and the IMF, they will have a role to play. And so, you know, but the U.S. right now vetoes all those kind of things, and it's not allowed under present sanction policy.
And we're just about out of time, but do you think that South Korea is going to be able to wiggle out from under the supervision of the United States?
Well, I think in some ways it already has, and I think it's going to take some time. But I think that it's really an evolving relationship, and I think there's going to be over time, as this new administration comes in, I think there's going to be other issues that come up. I mean, for example, they don't want to have it shoved down their throat that they have to buy American weapon systems. You know, they just were. You know, there was a huge lobbying campaign by Boeing and lawmakers in the Pentagon last year to have them buy Boeing instead of Dassault fighters for their next generation of fighter jets, and that caused a lot of resentment. It stirred up a lot of resentment there, and I think you're going to see them going their own way, politically and economically.
All right, thanks. We've got to end it there. Thanks. That's Tim Schrock, who is a journalist based just outside Washington, D.C. And you can check out Tim's piece on the Korean crisis in the forthcoming issue of The Nation. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I think I'm going to be preempted next week. So until I return, let's go out with Satoshi Tomy again.